Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Eli Gottlieb, who reads from and discusses his new book, Now You See Him, published by William Morrow. In the weeks to come, we have Russell Banks, Carlene Bryce, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. As an independent bookstore, the Tattered Cover is involved in something called BookSense, a program of the American Booksellers Association intended to raise awareness of the value of independent bookstores. Each month, booksellers across the country nominate their favorite new titles with the hopes of getting them to become one of 20 books chosen each month to become a BookSense pick. This month, in the coveted number one spot, sits Eli Gottlieb's book, Now You See Him. We additionally are proud to note that it was a Tattered Cover staff member, Joe Eichmann, whose quote was chosen to represent this pick. Also of note, Eli Gottlieb's book has been chosen as a Fox 31 Good Day Book Club. This is a monthly book club that shows Tuesday mornings at the 9 o'clock hour. It features our lead buyer, Kathy Langer, and Bill Husted, the Denver Post columnist. So as a particular bonus this month, it is 20% off, so buy as many as you'd like. But in celebration of the publication of Now You See Him, I'd like to now have my fellow bookseller, Joe Eichmann, come up and introduce Eli. Please welcome Joe Eichmann.
Thanks. So Christine told me I need to quote myself and just read the quote, because we're pretty proud. I'm not the only bookseller at the Tattered Cover that has loved this book. There's a whole slew of us that have. So this is the quote that is published in BookSense, the BookSense picks. It's, this nuanced, intelligent novel is told from the point of view of Nick, a man in his 30s facing a collapsing marriage and life as tragic events send him on a completely new road. Richly written, this thrilling novel's twists and revelations gloriously delve into the nature of truth, friendship, marriage, and our own perceptions of ourselves. I love this book. Eli Gottlieb's first novel, The Boy Who Went Away, won the Rome Prize and the 1998 McKittrick Prize from the British Society of Authors. And it was also a New York Times notable book. He has been an American literature lecturer at the University of Padua in Italy, where he lived, I think, for 8 years.
Total.
Currently, he lives in Boulder and is a contributing editor to 5280 magazine. Now You See Him is his second novel, and he just told us tonight is actually number 6 on the local bestsellers list. So I'm proud to welcome Eli Gottlieb to the Tattered Cover.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming, and thanks to the Tattered Cover, which is living up to its reputation as the best bookstore in the world. I'm just thrilled by the support and the enthusiasm that's pouring out of the store. I'm going to read. This novel is not a novel that lends itself that easily to be read. Either you have to do the voices, which is always a challenge, or you have to pick a piece that isn't necessarily of a piece with the rest of the book, and that has its own little narrative arc to it. I'm going to let me just tell you a little bit about the book, which is still for some reason difficult for me to do, in part because the book came to me in a very sort of organic way. I did not say, I'm going to write a book about the following themes in the following way, which is the way a lot of writers do. They have a kind of printed circuit diagram in their head of how they're going to go about it. It really, I had a scene in my head, and the book just sort of evolved around that. So when I'm asked, as I often am, what is it about, I'm really at a bit of a loss. It was about the experience of writing it. It's narrated by a guy who sort of idolized his friend across the street growing up. And the friend across the street ended up becoming a well-known writer, and whose career then flatlined. and committed a series of terrible crimes. The narrator begins to investigate his memories of this guy, and as he does, all these secondary things kick in, all these secondary mysteries begin to open up, and all these fault lines open up, and the assumptions that he had about his own life. And I kind of, the book sort of opens more about the charismatic writer and then eventually moves back into the narrator's life and then sort of switches back and forth in a series of alternating movements. The section that I'm going to read today is the section where it really definitively moves into the narrator's private life. So that's all you really need to know. It was as if, from the very beginning of my life, the deepest lessons offered me were to squelch my own desires and swallow the taste of my feelings in silence. The point my parents seemed to imply through their words and actions was not to offend or in any way draw attention to oneself, not out of adherence to some larger code of gentlemanly conduct, but because life itself was a highly breakable object, and as such must be approached sidelong and with the maximum caution. That being the case, it's little surprise that my mother and father never seemed particularly to care whether or not I was happy as a child. They did the necessary amount to sustain, clothe, and feed me, but I never felt that easy, lifted sense I perceived in the homes of my friends, whose families were organized around them so as to place them on pedestals of loving attention. No such elevation ever took place for me in our home. And yet, from as far back as I remember, my older brother Patrick seemed to dwell within a different world entirely, a world of parental recognitions ecstatically applied. Their voices were more vibrant around him, their laughter more frequent, deep, and sustained. I used to wonder if it wasn't simply that he, Patrick, had received the family's feelings firsthand, with the result that by the time they got to me, their freshness had been wilted by sustained handling, like old salad. Much of this withheld feeling I attached to my father. In memory, it's as if he passed my entire childhood silently seated at the dinner table with his hands templed together over his nose, his eyes suspended and seeming to float in space while he stared at me in a grave, faintly accusing way. That same pinched face is a constant in an otherwise whirling array of recollection, and I can shuffle those images like a deck of cards. Here he is at the annual Christmas party for his lab, morose among the noisemakers and confetti poppers, with me trailing behind him, grabbing his coattails, attacked by shyness. Here we are all together on vacation, sitting becalmed in a sailboat in the middle of an Adirondack lake, or grimly eating in the campus cafeteria on Parents' Day at college, or sitting on a Connecticut beach avoiding looking at one another with the crumbling, hissing folds of waves a distance off. At the center of it is that remarkable document, his face, from which, in memory, a radiant dourness seems to emanate, a little like the sunlit rays around the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill. Why, I often wondered, did he begrudge me the happiness of my boyhood? Why was he so unalterably opposed to my joy? There is a sound recording that exists of me as a 6-year-old child. I listened to it not long ago. On the tape, my voice can be heard breaking upward in little interrogative crests. Those crests, I remember them well, were so many entreaties that my father joined me in the excitement of childhood. They were my implicit requests that he play with me with the ease and amplitude he did my brother Patrick, and that we be, if even for a moment, like those other fathers I saw at school, who seemed to exist with their sons in a quiet trance of understanding, letting their arms fall casually across their shoulders, building pinewood derby cars with them in long hours of basement collaboration, or camping with them in the nearby Sawtooth Mountains and thereby opening up vistas of manly expertise. I wanted the dashing fathers of the Italian kids. I wanted the terrible drinking fathers of the Polish kids. I wanted anyone who would hold his son in the safe, boxed enclosure of a fatherly embrace. But my own father, though he knew that I'd clumsily fished for his approval for years, and knew as well that I was in love with the vast, cold competence with which he moved through life, my father simply sat before me throughout my childhood, as still as an Indian brave, the disembodied eyes floating in space, refusing to unbend an inch. And now, here, I'd like to talk of one particular night of our family history. I'd like to dwell on an evening of childhood summer during that time of late August when the Earth gives the impression of having slowed to a crawl in its orbit and standing ghosts of heat mist hover beneath the trees. I'd like to concentrate a moment on the three of us, mother, father, and myself, in the kitchen waiting for Patrick to return on his bicycle. My mother is at the stove amidst her chiming pots and pans. And seated at the table, I am attempting, as usual, to find such watercourses of enthusiasm as move beneath the dry surface of my father's disconnect. Should I try magnetism tonight? Or the truth about the curveball? Will it be Brownian motion, which makes the blue of the sky blue? Or the chemical history of a candle by Michael Faraday, which I've lately read and been stunned by? Intuitively, I'm sure, I've opened one of those subjects of science or physics about which my father can grudgingly be convinced to trickle out small explanations. Probably, almost certainly, I am rapt. It is then that we become suddenly aware of a disturbance in one corner of our peripheral vision. Appearing at the screen door, which has been left open because it is the 1970s and nothing bad will ever happen, is a man-sized shadow. The shadow, we presently realize, is a familiar form, and it is struggling to say something. It is our neighbor, Mark Castor. I know of my father's especial scorn for Mark Castor. He refers to him as a clothes horse and a goofball. He looks at him whenever the two men are in the same room with a special parched disdain. I've never understood his enmity toward a man who has always taken such pains to make me feel welcome in his presence. Tonight, he has done the rare thing of showing up at our front door, which he's almost never done before. Also, it's as if he's dancing under the influence of some strange music. He's thrashing his hands and waving his head back and forth. It looks a little like the twist. Suddenly, we understand his words. "It's Patrick," Mark is shouting. "He was hit by a car and the ambulance is coming. Come quick now, my God." Then he stops and merely stands there, his hands held up in the air, swaying. That's the scene, and it stays that way no matter how many times I replay it in my head. The three of us frozen in our places by news that is already bursting over us like a shell, and yet in memory forever still in the pre-ground of that tragedy, forever still on the near side of all that consequence, and for those slender few instants that remain, still a family comfortably upheld by having dodged so many of the unhappy outcomes of life. I watch our faces fall open in surprise as a pulsing, siren-like wail starts to pour from my mother's mouth. Can anguish change the shape of a life? The car, as it turns out, had crushed Patrick's skull. It hit him broadside, moving fast, and flung him high through the air and onto a lawn. Marks on his face of a vaguely cross-hatched pattern were later revealed to be the impress of the grill on his flesh. He lingered perfectly still in a coma for several days, then opened his eyes, made a small tasting movement of the lips as if in receipt of some new, not especially good information, and died. With his death, time stopped as it does when the projector jams at the theater and the handsome figures on the screen freeze and are cruelly lacerated by giant widening holes. The cleaning lady stopped coming. I no longer went to band practice. Inside the house, there was no radio, no television, no sound at all for days, save the surprisingly deep, masculine noises of my mother's grief as they drifted from the bedroom, and those of my father, who sobbed out loud in front of me and didn't care if I saw. But I did care, and it tore me up hugely. I sobbed along with him, but I wasn't crying only for my brother. I was also crying because I was shocked that the one untouchable thing in my life, my father's feelings, had been hit that hard and not for me. In the days after the funeral, I spent a lot of time visiting compulsively with my brother's orphaned keepsakes and toys. It wasn't only that his baseball mitt, his little tin trophies, his white plastic flute, his gem collection, his train set, his plastic soldiers, and his three-quarter-size Colt revolver reminded me of him. It was that his sudden death had turned these possessions directional. They continued to move ahead in time, as if there was a lag between this world and the next, and the news hadn't yet reached them of their owner's death. And in the meantime, stranded between worlds, they must continue to carry on as plucky little bits of metal and plastic and leather, waiting for a human touch to set them to life. Maybe that's why, when no one was watching, I crept into his room and held them individually in my hands for hours at a time, staring at them like you might a bunch of baby rabbits discovered magically unharmed beneath the blades while mowing the lawn, and said strange, impulsive things to them day after day, which made me feel better. 6 months after Patrick's death, his room was repapered and hung with new curtains and carpets. A gigantic television was installed where his bed had been, and my father, mainly, sat staring at it blankly on evenings and weekends. As for me, many years later, having long ago stopped thinking about my brother, I found myself strangely sensitive to the way in which his features would show up in other people. I once felt instantly at home with a gas station attendant because he had my brother's nose, and for a moment hungrily probed his background in a way I would realize only later was a groping on my part toward an old flickering pulse of feeling. I was unnaturally warm with an elderly woman who picked at the corner of her mouth with her pinky like my brother did, or sneezed with his funny little ladylike report, or I would notice how the shape of someone's head precisely mimicked what I had always thought of as his, and would sidle up to that person at a party and speak with inappropriate candor out of the feeling that we were part of some larger conspiracy dedicated to keeping an old memory alive. My dear, dead, freckled brother. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Russell Banks, Carlene Bryce, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 7th, 2008.